Macromedia.com.
Major funding for The Connection is provided by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. In Source, in Mark Doty's newest collection of poetry, the pages are filled with what anyone who's familiar with Doty's work would expect. Words like gleam and gold and references to stars, a yellow band of dunes, a sparkling city, tulips, medlars, and the union of sunlight with roses. A nod to Elizabeth Bishop, Walt Whitman, old houses, picket fences, and white boats in Provincetown waters. What some may not expect, however, is a sort of a shift in vision, a new subject matter, an exploration of America. Mark's known as the lyrical voice that chronicled the AIDS epidemic. He wrote for years about anticipated grief and gripping loss in the gay community, and now he's looking outward in a quest not just for the self, but where the self resides in the nation's soul, in all its ties that bind, in all its broken bits. Connection listeners, what speaks to you in Doty's verse? And what do you think makes a poem an American poem? Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me today from a studio in New York City is the poet, Mark Doty. Hi, Mark.
Hi, Dick. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks. Boy, lots of complicated questions for the listeners. Can I ask? Can I ask you if you've got an idea what makes a poem an American poem?
Well, I do have an idea about that. You know, the great grandparents of contemporary American poetry are, of course, Walt Whitman and Emily Dickinson, two poets who, in very different ways, pursued the investigation of what it means to be a person. What is a self? Where does a self stop? What are its boundaries? What are its contents? What is the connection of self to the world? Dickinson, of course, did that through her rigorous introspection, through examining every nuance of feeling. Whitman did it through projecting himself outward, finding himself mirrored in here in New York, in New Jersey, in Brooklyn, in all the world around him. But those models have shaped for us our sense of an American poem, a poem that tries to place a self in context, that tries to know the world by knowing us first.
You choose to start this collection, Source, with a poem called A Little Rabbit Dead in the Grass. I'm going to ask you to read it because not only is it a terrific poem, but I think in a way it'll help us move to a better understanding of where your poetry fits in what you were just describing. Am I choosing a good poem to demonstrate that?
Well, I think that there's a reason that this poem is the first one in the book, and I'm happy to read it. Let me say first that the poem refers to the Hindu god Shiva, who we usually think of as the god of destruction. Shiva dances at the end of time to destroy creation. But Shiva is also a creator, and in one story of his creation, Shiva began the world by speaking a single syllable. This is called A Little Rabbit Dead in the Grass. All that was quick, soul of dart and hurry. No soul now, and still the body, not even the length of my hand, seems poised for springing, legs jutting forward and back as if in mid-leap. And here comes the so of poetry. Just one bunny, dead of mysterious causes, one among legion. Though this particular shocks early in the frosty grass by the kitchen door, where each specific blade makes, as always, the carpeting text of their journey work, the old blab of the grass's book. Everything and nothing, the page says, though you turn it round and round, each and all, though you can't help set yourself the task of explication. The elegist's thankless work. So long, so what? Once only, these two shoeblack pupils, though behind the daylights, a pressure of new rabbits, reinforcements eager to arrive. Animals, themselves, and nothing but an instance of some more general rule. Beloved, because we can almost bear it, and therefore love them more, how each dog's any, every lemon-scaled fandango in the restaurant tank, the perfect incarnation of carp. Couldn't you be happy with that? No, says the sow. No rest for the sow. Shiva built the world, the story goes, on a single syllable, heavenly irritant, and the pearl of reality grew. Imagine, so, right at the heart of the world. My littlest question, curve of the sibilant sliding into the aperture of O, brief, uncrackable syllable, which seems to flicker in the oystery gleam of the ears, narrower than thumb tips, and on the minute, eraser-colored nose, artfully crafted thing, and on the slender brow, where some trace of thought seems written.
That's A Little Rabbit Dead in the Grass, the opening poem in a new collection by Mark Doty. Mark, when you compose your poetry, do you do it out loud?
I begin scribbling in notebooks, making sort of random notes on the computer screen, and very quickly I find myself mouthing those words, wanting to feel the language and the muscles of my jaw and my tongue. And pretty soon I'm muttering to myself at my desk and, frequently taken for a person who's a little too far gone into his inner life in public spaces.
But they're written to be read out loud.
They're written to be heard. And you know, even when we read a poem alone, I hope that what's happening is that there's a subtle kind of sounding going on, that we're physically participating in those words, in the sonic texture of the verse. Poetry lives to be physical, to be in our bodies.
You've chosen a poem about, in a way, about nature. Right, the little mm-hmm. rabbit, though, mm-hmm. And I guess I'm wondering whether or not that's, in a way, joining the one of the major themes of American poetry, and that is the interaction of the people and this land.
Absolutely. We have always looked to the natural world for instruction and for a metaphor. And our great American teachers, I'm thinking of Emerson in particular, whose ideas inform both Whitman and Dickinson, told us not to listen to the preachers, not to follow the sacred texts, but to follow our eyes, to study the world around us and try to read it for instruction. And this has been a crucial current in American poetry ever since, that if we study the natural world, if we look at the given, we can find our way inside. We can find our way behind the visible toward a deeper understanding. That's the hope.
is that why you like Whitman as much as you do?
That's part of why I like Whitman. I think it also has to do with a common apprehension between Uncle Walt and I that the self doesn't quite seem to stop at the boundaries of the skin, that we are, in fact, always slipping or leaking a little out of ourselves to feel part of other people, part of some particular aspect of the world. And I don't know that anybody ever said that as beautifully as Walt Whitman did.
You went back to his house, his grave?
Went to his house, which is in Camden, New Jersey. This is the last house in which he lived, and it's still standing. And it's a strange place to visit because Camden is now one of the most battered inner cities in America. And there, across from a big jail, on a very sorely tattered city street, is a tiny frame house. You have to buzz to be let inside. And once you enter that little early Victorian simple home, there are Walt Whitman's possessions scattered around you, his backpack, letters of invitation, testimonials, fan mail. And the thing that moved me most, his parrot. which is about 7 or 8 inches tall, stuffed in a little glass case. And when I saw that bird and thought, you sat on Walt Whitman's shoulder, I felt a kind of shiver. That was the thing that made Walt Whitman real to me. Maybe for the first time.
I liked your description of the backpack. Hear your backpack crumpled like a leather sigh.
What a shocking thing to see something used every day by someone who, you know, for me, is a hero of the imagination, who is larger than life.
And the bird. Like, why is it that the glass eye of a stuffed bird in a bell jar drew you in?
How can we explain what it is that serves as a catalyst for us? Well, poets by nature are metaphoric thinkers, yes? We often do not know what we feel or think about anything until we have a vehicle, until we have an image which can contain meaning for us. And what happens for me is that I apprehend an image. I'm struck by a metaphor long before I have any idea what it means to me, before I have any sense of what might lie behind that. And when I met that parrot, what was left of that parrot, what I felt was a kind of shiver and a kind of sense of connection to the past, but mostly a sense of awe that I really didn't understand. And it was in the act of describing that bird, trying to unpack that awe, if you will, while I'm writing the poem, that I come to know why it mattered to me in the first place. And this is a kind of model of my process as a poet, that there's always so much I don't know. What I know is that an image, a detail, is tugging at my sleeve. It's saying, look at me, think about me, write about me.
And the write about me part of that image, while you're watching a little kid kneeling and staring at a shop window, whether or not you're looking at a pail of turtles or a parrot in a jar, does your mind go to work right at that moment saying, what are the words that'll help the people who read my poetry understand what I'm feeling now?
Usually, not exactly. What happens at the beginning is a sense of being struck, and some of those experiences of being, you know, touched by the world become poems, and some of them do not. It's the ones that stay with me, the ones that haunt, if you will, that I have to find language for. And usually you don't know that right away. You know that a little later when something won't go away. We all see, you know, thousands, hundreds of thousands of details every day, but only a few of them lodge within us. Only a few of them seem finally to matter. And I have to wait for those.
So it was after you'd left the house and the parrot was still in your mind, or the leather backpack, and you're sort of like, okay, then they work.
That's right. And you know what happens otherwise? You see, if you try to describe your experience as it's happening to you, then you're trying to cannibalize it. You're trying to use it. And poetry resists that.
Connection listeners, our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. My guest this hour is Mark Doty. His latest collection of poetry is called Source. My name's Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. You're listening to The Connection from NPR. My name's Dick Gordon. This is an hour when we're talking about poetry. Here's one. The beards of the young men glistened with wet. It ran from their long hair. Little streams passed all over their bodies. An unseen hand also passed over their bodies. It descended trembling from their temples and ribs. The young men float on their backs. Their white bellies bulge to the sun. They do not ask who seizes fast to them. They do not know who puffs and declines with pendant and bending arch. They do not think whom they souse with spray. My guest, Mark Doty, will be able to tell you exactly who wrote that, because he answered it in a poem in his latest collection. Mark,
it's wonderful
when I
to hear you read that, Dick. That was great.
When I read your letter to Walt Whitman, there was this sort of thundering deja vu that came out of the place when you refer back to that type of image that Whitman does so well. And in fairness, I should get you to read. It's quite long. Can you read us a portion of the letter to Walt Whitman?
Yes, I'm going to read you just a little bit of it. This is a poem which was actually originated with a commission from the BBC Radio, and they had given me 15 minutes of airtime. I thought, I'll never fill 15 minutes of airtime. And then I found once I began talking to Whitman, I really couldn't stop. So this is just a bit. I have some questions for you. Did you mean it? Democratic America joined by delight in the beauty of boys, especially working class ones? I joke. I know you meant adhesiveness. That bond of flesh to equal flesh might be the bedrock of an order, a compact founded on skin's durable, knowable flame. I've felt what I think you meant. I don't mean to romance this, Walt, but much of what I've known of fellowship I've apprehended in the basest church, where we're seldom dressed, and the affable equality among worshippers is sometimes like your democratic vista, men held in common by our common skin. But it doesn't take sex to understand. Once, in a beachside changing shed, packed with men, all girths and degrees of furred and smooth, firm and softened, fish belly to warm rose to midnight's dimmest spaces between stars, sunburnt on my bench, waiting my turn in the mist of shower steam, I thought, we're all here, every one of us, the men of the world in the men's house, nude, buffed with towels, young men and old and boys bathing together. So much flesh in one place, it seemed to be of the soul. As if I stood in that fogged original room through which each individual enters the world, and each of us, nameless, already in the body that would be ourselves, was awaiting his turn. So we stood in sympathy, since we understood our fellows would suffer, knew we were entering upon our singular shared lot. And I can understand how you might base on that a nation, Walt. Though each of us left the warm and darkened shed in separate clothes, in separate cars, which drained out of the parking lot onto the blacktop and the expressway back to the city, headed home to the song of myself, self, self. That moment, unguarded, skin to skin, why didn't it make us change?
Mark Doty reading just a portion of his letter to Walt Whitman from his latest collection, Source. When you asked him at the beginning, I have some questions for you. I wondered whether or not you were saying, has anything changed? Is it just the same? What was the question?
Yes, and also, you know, what an extraordinarily radical vision to say that we are all one body, that we might be joined by adhesiveness to become a single community, a single state, equals, each person of equal value. I mean, not only is that a radical thing to say today, it was an extraordinary thing to say, you know, in 1860.
Whitman wrote as a gay poet, and you do too. Your work that you're perhaps best known for are the poems writing about Wally and the ill AIDS and the death and the time after that. Does that give you a connection to Whitman?
Well, of course, because you know, one of the odd things about being a gay writer is that it's difficult to find one's tradition. Tradition is there, but, you know, I didn't grow up talking about it, and I didn't have the sense that I had progenitors as a gay writer. I had to go look for them. They weren't being shown to me in school, or you know, we read Whitman, of course, you know, just as we read Hart Crane and just as we read Elizabeth Bishop, but we didn't talk about them in that light, and therefore I felt oddly isolate, as if I were making something up. So it's been very important for me to claim ancestry. You know, Harold Bloom has a famous notion that writers are always trying to sort of, you know, kill off their progenitors and hide the evidence. But I think that for gay writers, it's somewhat the opposite. We want to place our tradition in our poems. We want to invoke the masters, the figures who helped us become ourselves, because it's a way of claiming a family.
And when we read Whitman today, we don't read him as first a gay poet and then an American poet. He's an American poet.
And he's a human poet.
Right.
You know, he is a person. He's an international poet now because, you know, that work has no boundaries.
And it's a step that you're making with Source.
One would like to be able to say that.
I think
one of the things I'll tell you what Source does differently in my mind, that most of my work has been very attached to a particular story, a dramatic event in my life. As you said, the struggles of the AIDS epidemic, the anticipated death of my partner and the period of grief thereafter. And it was important to me to chronicle those experiences, but I hope that I have moved in my work a little bit away from chronicling the story of my life. I would like to be able, in these newer poems, to look at the world as myself, but also invite the reader in to also be the I in the poem, to participate with me in experience in a way that's not especially dependent upon circumstance or autobiography. In other words, you don't need to share much about my life in order to enter the world of these poems.
Connection,
it's a new goal for me.
Connection listeners, do you feel invited in the poetry of Mark Doty? Our number is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. And we're going first to Saranac Lake, New York. Meg's calling in. Hi, Meg.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, thanks.
I'm calling because Mark Doty is my favorite writer.
Oh.
And Heaven's Coast is my favorite book after Moby Dick.
Wow.
I'll just put that first, but a little bit first. And I've been trying to figure out what it is, of course, that I like so much about Mark Doty. And there are so many things that it's difficult to talk about. But I'm a visual artist, and so I understand the whole idea of the metaphor. And I'm currently actually working on a print that will take in the last few lines of his poem After the Fourth, which is in Source.
Mm-hmm.
We flare and fail in shallows, burn in the liquid open. A wild, deep current brought us. I just love those lines, and so I'm working on a visual image. But one of the things that I wanted to ask him about was the whole idea that he talks about of finding history, because I notice in a lot of his work that he's very connected to old things. And that's always been a struggle for me because I'm so future-oriented. So to make a connection with old things, like the idea of polishing the old floor of the house, is something that interests me, and I wondered if he could talk a little bit about that.
Thank you, Meg. I'm grateful to have a reader who is so scrupulously attentive. And I love the idea of you translating some of these words into visual images, partly because, of course, they begin as visual images that are then translated into words. Old things. Well, you know, I was a suburban kid. I grew up in the Sun Belt. I was an army brat. We moved from place to place, and we lived in sprawly new suburbs where there was usually very little evidence of history, or what evidence was there, we didn't know how to see. And it has been so important to me in my adult life to look for places of inhabitation evidence of use, homes, places that carry something of the weight of the used past, the presence of human feeling. Because without that, I feel like I'm, you know, back in suburban Tucson again, and I'm floating on the surface of time, which is not where I want to live.
Mark, can you read for us The Love of Old Houses? It's the poem that Meg's referring to, and for those who haven't yet seen the collection of poetry, I mean, it expresses so beautifully that very same sentiment.
This is a poem that has to do with my house in Provincetown, which is an 18th century house, and like, you know, when I bought the house, it had shag carpeting and drop ceilings and paneling, and you know, many sorry things have been done to it. And like everyone who buys an old house to restore, I had those dreams that behind the sheetrock would be the beehive oven, you know, and or the murals, or who knows what might be back there. And in fact, what was back there was absolutely nothing. Somebody had gotten some money in the 1880s or 1890s during the whaling boom in Provincetown, and they had modernized the house. So all that was left, with a sense of character and of time, were these beautiful, wide planked floorboards. This is called Essay, The Love of Old Houses. A glow from rough planed floorboards, knotted and grained and chestnut hued, and flecked in the pores with bits of antique paint. Whale oil and lead for red. Was it arsenic that made this green? Remnants grace the pitted spots where the sander wouldn't reach. Well, it could have. But what we wanted when we took the burr wheel's unwieldy drum to these planks was to honor the whorls and curves that made them themselves, variant, well used, like skin. Fired just now, by afternoon, pouring heat and honey onto these wide swaths, seasoned 2 centuries to something durable. Too much an inhabitation of warmth to qualify as inanimate. As though sunlight softened their cooled human store and sent it wafting up like scent from warmed wax. I know. I am that firing light. And I'm the hand that's oiled these boards with a rosin and varnish brew. Tincture that let these cello depths emerge and last. And so what we've made is not outside myself, not exactly. Rather, it's a container, sagging and shored, corroding and replenished, in which one doesn't need to hold oneself together. Relax, and oh, the rooms will do it for you. It's safe to loosen our borders here and know ourselves housed. I sanded and Danished oiled these floors with a man who's dead, and the planks gleam still, a visible form of vitality, for you and I, love, who now revise, as each inhabitant must, the dwelling place, making new builds upon every layer come before. We're joined to whoever wore the stair-step down, or cracked the corner of a window pane, or waxed these boards when company was coming. Which is why I like old houses best. Here it's proved that time requires a deeper, better verb than pass. It's more like pool, and ebb, and double back again. My history, his, yours, subsumed into the steadying frame of a phrase I love, a building, both noun and verb, where we live and what we do, fill it with ourselves, all the way to the walls, proximity made bearable by separate, commingling privacies that spill and meet at the edge as clouds do, and together comprise an atmosphere. Our place. What else is new? A broom for you, a stack of rags for me, our own old t-shirts cut to squares and once again of use, a tin of wax, these lovely smells, tropical rosin, petroleum.
That's Essay, The Love of Old Houses, read by Mark Doty. Our number's 1-800-423-8255. Meg, are you still with me?
Yes.
Isn't that nice?
That was wonderful. Mm-hmm. It's wonderful to hear him read.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's quite different, I find, from scanning the lines on the page. But, I mean, I think that's probably always the case with poetry, isn't it, Mark?
I do think so. The line is, of course, the signal characteristic of a poem. It's, you know, we know something is a poem usually because it comes to us in lines. But I think of the line as a private pleasure. It's something we experience with the eye and with the ear, alone with the poem. When you hear the poem read, I hope that you hear sentences, not lines. I want to move you through the poem's argument of sentence making, if you will, so that you participate in another way.
So, Meg, are you any closer to figuring out what it is about this guy's writing that you like?
I think it always takes me to new territory. For example, connecting the boards, the three people involved, the old T-shirts, with the wax, with the tools that you use, but the idea that everything is connected, that everything has kind of an aura that sort of slips and slides between each object or person, I think is something that I hadn't considered too much before. It's sort of like life and objects are fluid and flow into one another. Like when putting Wally's ashes into the ocean, and the ashes and the ocean mingle with the sand and the light and the person watching, that kind of thing.
This must be true for painters, too, that objects are vessels of feeling. We use them to hold emotion, time, connection.
Right.
Meg, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome.
Nice to have you on the program. Boy. Should get people like that to speak to you on a regular basis.
You paid her to call in today, yes? No, I should have paid her to call in.
We don't have to. You've got lots of fans here. Mark Doty is my guest. Connection listeners, our number's 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. There is a new collection of poems. It's called Source. When we come back after the break, we'll talk further with Mark about how he sees this shifting himself as a writer in this landscape. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
Funding for The Connection is made possible by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.org.
You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. My name's Dick Gordon. My guest this hour, Mark Doty, author of 6 volumes of poetry. His latest one is called Source. Mark also is a professor of creative writing at the University of Houston. He's won a pile of prizes, the Los Angeles Times Book Award, the National Book Critics Circle Award, I never get that one right, the Boston Review Poetry Award, and Britain's T.S. Eliot Prize, the only American poet to have captured this award. Mark, when we were talking a little bit earlier about the place of the person in a country, you in America, I'm thinking, you know, the rabbit is just one, but then there's this whole rush of rabbits ready to come. There's just you sanding that floor, and then generations of people who will walk on it and live in that house. It is, in many ways, a lot about, you know, being a part of something bigger, a part of something much longer than the span of a human life, I guess.
And there's always that contradiction for us, isn't there, that we are just a little piece of the whole, and yet to ourselves, of course, we are the world, and we do not wish to disappear. We want our individual lives to continue, and yet I think we also crave the permanency of the ongoing, you know? Everything that's singular will vanish, but the whole life, the collective human project, we think, will last. It goes on, and we want that ongoingness, and we want our separateness at once. And I think that polarity, that tension, is part of what makes us human.
Is it also a polarity between the kind of rooted individualism that we know to be American and the more spiritual transcendentalism that you referred to earlier in the program?
Well, I think, you know, part of our... I've had to think a lot, I guess, about what Americanness is in recent years because I've been lucky enough to be published elsewhere. And nobody thinks of themselves as an American writer until you go to London or you go to Mexico City or you go to Italy and suddenly you feel very, very American. You realize that there are particular characteristics of your thinking and of your voice which have to do with place and with culture. I think it's true that Americans are, we long for the connectedness of home. We want those floorboards that are ours, that we live with over time. And we're also unbelievably restless. We want fluidity and mobility. We don't want to miss anything. We want to be part of the pulse of life.
Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255 to Cambridge, Massachusetts. Scott's calling in. Hi, Scott.
Hello there. How are you?
Fine, thanks.
Good. I'm at work right now and was listening to the conversation you both were having and was struck by one particular comment by Mr. Doty, and that was having to do with history. It just hit me, and I'm at a loss for words, so bear with me. But I just turned 30, and it looks as though I'm turning back to look for things in my life that have meaning in my past, so I can move forward. And that was just a comment that I wanted to make. That it did hit me in a rather unusual way. I wasn't expecting it, and was very, very moved.
Something about those round numbers, the 30 and 40 and the one that I'm pushing up against, that mid-century mark, that certainly sends you into examination of where you've been.
Yeah, it's amazing because I'm living and working in Cambridge and am longing to go to just go home and see my dog and look at the hardwood floors and that sort of thing. And, I'm just amazed and very touched by that comment and thought I'd let you know.
Thank you. I think, you know, that longing for home is so much a characteristic of our nature and yet also, you know, our confusion about just where home is. Where do we locate ourselves? So, you know, where do meaning and value reside? And in some way, I guess I feel like my home has come to be within these pages.
But in just in geographical terms or in personal terms, Mark, whether it's Vermont or Provincetown or Houston, when you've written so revealingly about so much of the past, your past that we now know. Does that give you a platform then, a place to stand to go beyond that?
I think so, because, you know, Provincetown is a place that has been enormously important to me as a kind of imaginative location. It's a place where some of the central dramas of my life have occurred, and a place that's small enough that you can know it very well, so that it has continually provided me with beginning points and of course with endless sources of metaphor, because that landscape is so striking, so fluid and powerful. And that home base has indeed let me wander off to spend time, you know, in New York, in Houston, in Utah, the other parts of the country too. And I do lots of travel as a visiting writer and speaker. Increasingly, it's that citizenship of the larger world I wish to try to address. And I'm not always sure how to do that in a poem, you know, because one of the risks of writing a kind of public poetry is to use public language, which is deadly. For a poem to work, this sort of poem, it would need to talk about the issues of common life, but to use private language, the personal idiosyncratic speech of a poem, to make that public life feel real to the reader.
Hmm. Scott, thanks for your call.
Thank you for having me.
All right. We're going to Rensselaer Falls, New York. Elizabeth is joining us. Hi, Elizabeth.
Good morning.
Hi, thanks for calling.
I was thinking about the old floors in the house. That was the only thing that seemed to be really genuine, really old and genuine. Mm-hmm. And it brought to mind a line of Latin poetry, Sunt Lacrimae Rerum. Anybody know it? Probably not. At any rate, Latin's got budgeted out of school.
Tears is in there somewhere, but that's the closest I can get.
Well, there are tears of things.
Oh.
It's from the Aeneid. Aeneas was in the Battle of Troy, in the destruction of Troy, after the Trojan horse came in, and he escaped. He's been wandering. He's found a place where he is remembered and where he can stay for a while at least. And he sees these murals, pictures of the actual battles and destruction of Troy, and it brings it back to his mind. And he says, there are tears of things.
Hmm.
And the first time
quotation.
You read that, you say, what the heck? But it's the same thing, only his is on this much more personally involved scale. You see these things, but the things, some of the things are still there.
There's a part of the program that we began with when I was quoting one of Mark's poems, Elizabeth, when he talks about the mirror that just gets so old that it eventually gets filled up with the images and doesn't reflect things back. It's kind of the same as what you're describing.
Yes, well, my sisters and I are, we're in our 70s and 80s, and we are looking back, and we get together, we think maybe somebody should have a tape recorder, and we talk about how far back can we remember. And one of my sisters said, what's the earliest thing you can remember about Mother?
Elizabeth, you got to get yourself a tape recorder. Don't wait for someone to bring one to the house. Thanks for calling in.
All right, thank you.
Nice to have you on the program. Mark, I do want to have you read one more poem, and I should put you to work now so find that we're running out of time near the end of the program. Can you close with the poem that closes Source, the one by the same name?
I can. This is a poem, the spring poem. Source. I'd been traveling all day, driving north. Smaller and smaller roads, clabbered houses startled awake by the new green around them. When I saw three horses in a fenced field by the narrow highway's edge. White horses, two uniformly snowy, the other speckled as though he'd been rolling in flakes of rust. They were of graduated sizes, small, medium, large, and two stood to watch while the smallest waded in a shallow pond, tossing his head and taking, it seemed unmistakable, delight in the cool water around his hooves and ankles. I kept on driving. I went into town to visit the bookstores and the coffee bar and looked at the new novels and the volumes of poetry, but all the time it was horses I was thinking of. And when I drove back to find them, the three companions left off whatever it was they were playing at and came nearer the wire fence I'd pulled over onto the grassy shoulder of the highway to see what I'd brought them. Experience is an intact fruit, core and flesh and rind of it. Once cut open, entered, it can't be the same, can it? Though that is the dream of the poem, as if we could look out through that moment's blushed skin. They wandered toward the fence. The tallest turned toward me. I was moved by the verticality of her face, elongated reach from the ear tips down to white eyelids and lashes, the pink articulation of nostrils. Wind stirring the strands of her mane a little to frame the gaze in which she fixed me. She was the bold one. The others stood at a slight distance while she held me in her attention. Put your tongue to the green-flecked peel of it, reader, and taste it from the inside. Would you believe me if I said that beneath them a clear channel ran from the three horses to the place they'd come from, the cool womb of nothing, cave at the heart of the world, deep and resilient and firmly set at the core of things. Not emptiness, not negation, but a generous, cold nothing. The breathing space, out of which new shoots are propelled to the grazing mouths, out of which horses themselves are tendered into the new light. The poem wants the impossible. The poem wants a name for the kind nothing at the core of time, out of which the foals come tumbling, curled, fetal, dreaming, and into which the old crumple, fetlock and skull breaking like waves of foaming milk. Cold, bracing nothing, which mothers forth mud and mint, hoof and clover, root hair and horsehair, and the accordion bones of the rust-spotted little one unfolding itself into the afternoon. You too. You flare and fall back into the necessary open space. What could be better than that? It was the beginning of May, the black earth nearly steaming, and a scatter of petals decked the mud like pearls, everything warm with setting out. And you could see, beneath their hooves, the path they'd traveled up, the horse road on which they trot into the world, eager for pleasure and sunlight, and down which they descend, in good time, into the source of spring.
I hear you writing about you in that poem.
Do you? Yes. There is, of course, a desire to see ourselves through things. There are some things you can't say directly. There are some things you are enormously difficult to approach by trying to talk about them head on. And through the veil, if you will, of the thing, perhaps as our caller said, through the tears of things, you might come closer to being able to speak what would otherwise prove unsayable.
There was an observation that you made, and we're very short of time. I'll ask for a quick answer to this, that at the time of writing, when death was around you, you had this state of heightened awareness. Can you go back there now? Can you use that? Is it a window, a passageway you still use?
In a way, I suppose. I think once you've lived through the intensity and intimacy of someone's death with them, it becomes part of you forever in some way. It's not that I live in that state of consciousness, because no one can, but experience teaches us if we're lucky.
Mark, thanks so much.
Great pleasure, Dick. Thank you.
Poet Mark Doty is the author of his latest collection called Source. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.
Funding for The Connection is made possible by Macromedia.